Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin here with us this hour as we continue with Open Forum. Your calls are welcome, 888-318-7884. Open Forum means open to anyone, whatever your religious persuasion, and open to just about any question you got. Jimmy's pretty open to your questions, whether they have to do with the church, morality, philosophy, or maybe you want to talk about science or science fiction or something like that. Jimmy's happy to take your call, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's been a long time. Nice to see you again, Jimmy.
Yeah, likewise. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. Still recovering from a trip. I don't recover as well as I expected to. I think I'm getting old.
Your sense of balance hasn't fully restored yet after being upside down for a couple weeks?
It's weird to hang upside down. The blood's rushing back to my feet now. And so, I feel like it's a hard adjustment. But yeah, it does feel like as each year passes and I get older, my recovery time is a little bit longer than it used to be. Again, 888-318-7884. Tomorrow, a new episode will drop on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And Jimmy, what do we got?
Well, so from the early days of Mysterious World, we developed a couple of tongue-in-cheek sayings. The first one was, it's always aliens, because that's one of the options people leap to when they consider what might explain something mysterious. And the other one is, it's always demons, because that's the other hypothesis that people tend to leap to whenever they're considering what might explain something mysterious. But there are some people who want to say it's always alien demons, that in other words, all aliens are demons. So if you see a UFO or you meet an alien, it's really a demon trying to trick you somehow. And there have even been people, now a lot of people just assert that with no argumentation, which is frankly lame, because if you're going to assert something, you need to have reasons for it.
Yeah.
But there have been people who've tried to argue this. And I found a book by a couple of evangelical authors who make an extensive argument that it's always alien demons. And so in tomorrow's show, we're going to look at their arguments and see why they fail.
Ah, very good. All right. Well, they kind of set a double hard thing for themselves. They're talking about aliens and demons. They've doubled the degree of difficulty. But they fail, huh?
They fail pretty hard, actually.
Yeah. Well, how would a demon even fly a spaceship? I don't even.
Demons! I don't have a problem with that. Okay. It's not could demons do it. It's what evidence do we have that demons are doing it, or must be the explanation?
All right. Well, as I said, they drop every Friday. It'll drop tomorrow morning. So check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Did I miss good ones while I was gone?
You did. You missed a couple of episodes looking at the 1890s mystery airships that appeared in 1896 and 1897 in the United States. And some people in the UFO community cite them as the first, as like the earliest UFOs, at least in recent times, and as evidence of extraterrestrial contact. And I conclude that they're not that, but they were something. And I actually tracked down what exactly they were and named the people involved.
Oh, good. So a mystery with a solution.
Yeah.
Not just an open-ended mystery. All right. Okay. I have to check them out. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to mysterious.fm. Jimmy, shall we go to the phones? They're all full.
Sure.
All right. Let's start with Connie in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Connie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. I wanted to know what Jesus meant when he referred to himself as the Son of Man.
Yeah, so this is a question that a lot of people have. In the Gospels, we have Jesus described both as the Son of God and the Son of Man, and some people have tried to explain it by proposing that he's referring to the two parts of his nature, his divine as a composite being. He has his divine nature, which is fundamental, and then he has this added human nature when he became incarnate. And so some people have proposed, well, when he's referred to as the Son of God, that's highlighting his divine nature. But when he refers to himself as the Son of Man, he's highlighting his human nature. And that's not on its face unreasonable. In fact, on its face, that's a pretty reasonable interpretation. In fact, we have precedent in the Old Testament for the term Son of Man just being used to mean a human. For example, in the book of Ezekiel, God periodically addresses the prophet Ezekiel and says, Son of Man, do this, or Son of Man, do that. And he just means, he's just referring to Ezekiel as a human being. And so it's not unreasonable, if you don't know anything else, to assume that that's what Jesus meant. But we now do know some other things. It turns out, if you study Jewish literature from the period in which Jesus lived, and this is known as the Second Temple era, because Solomon's temple had been destroyed and the new temple had been built, so this is the Second Temple era. And if you study Jewish literature from the Second Temple era, you find out that the term Son of Man came to have a special meaning. And we see kind of the groundwork for this meaning in the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, at one point, Daniel has a vision of the what he calls the Ancient of Days, by which he means God, sitting on a throne in heaven. And there are other thrones up there, too. And so he's getting a vision of God in his heavenly court. And then, riding on a cloud of heaven, he sees one like a son of man. That's how Daniel describes him, one like a son of man. And he's presented before the Ancient of Days. So he rides up to God on a cloud, and he's presented before him in his royal court in heaven. And he's given everlasting dominion over all people. And so the question is, who is this mysterious figure that's He, you know, obviously has some similarities to humans because he's said to be like us, but is he one of us? Well, that's where it gets interesting, because humans live on Earth. They don't live up in the clouds. And this figure comes riding on a cloud. And riding on a cloud is a typical symbol for how God arrives. God is described as being a cloud rider. And so what a lot of people in Judaism in the Second Temple era said is, this is, he may look like a human, but he's not quite a human. He's a divine figure. He doesn't come from the earth in Daniel's vision. He's already up in heaven, and he rides clouds like God does. And so they would identify this Son of Man figure as another divine figure. He's sometimes called the second power in heaven next to God. He's also sometimes called the lesser Yahweh, indicating he is Yahweh, but he's sort of distinct from Yahweh. And there are discussions of the Son of Man that grew out of this tradition. For example, there's a book known as First Enoch, which was written mostly in the first few centuries before Christ. And it's got a lot of stuff in it about the Son of Man. And it has the Son of Man as this heavenly figure who's going to come at the end of time, and he's going to be given dominion over all people. And in First Enoch, it identifies Enoch as the Son of Man, but that's not the only possible the only possible identification. Well, when Jesus in Mark's gospel is on trial before Caiaphas, the high priest says to him, tell us plainly who you are. Are you the son of the blessed? You know, are you the son of God? And Jesus says, I am, and from now on, you're going to see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. So Jesus is saying, that's who I am. I'm that heavenly Son of Man from Daniel's vision. I'm that guy. I'm the second power in heaven. I'm the lesser Yahweh. And so even though Son of Man previously in Israelite history had just meant a human being, in the Second Temple era, when Jesus lived, it had come to mean a special divine figure that ruled with God in heaven over all peoples. And that's what Jesus means when he identifies himself as the Son of Man.
Connie, how's that for you?
That's great. That's great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks very, very much for the call. You brought us right up to the break, so we'll take that break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Are you prepared to vote?
Citizens have co-responsibility for society, and this duty especially obliges those in a democracy who must elect representatives to run the state on their behalf.
Learn more so you're prepared when you vote this November. Visit EWTN.com/vote for everything Catholic voters need to know before picking up a ballot.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, we have a rewards program over at shop.catholic.com. In addition to the fall sale that's going on right now, you can sign up for rewards points. You just go to shop.catholic.com and then /rewards. And everything you buy, you get some points. You know how a rewards program works. I don't have to tell you how a rewards program works. It's just that we got one. Check it out at shop.catholic.com. Open forum this hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and Richard is in San Pablo, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Richard, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. So I was asked by the Missionaries of Charity to evangelize a young 18-year-old man who's been baptized, but he has not received the sacrament of the First Communion and confirmation. Mm-hmm. I don't have a relationship with this young man, and so how would I approach him to evangelize him, to motivate him to go to RCIA or to get those sacraments?
Well, there's no single answer to this. It's going to depend on the individual and what his personal state is, what his personal inclinations are. And if you don't already know that, then the first thing to do is start asking him questions. Also, if you don't have a relationship with him, you may want to start building a relationship with him. You know, say, hey, you want to go out and get a cup of coffee or a Coke or a hamburger or go watch a sports ball game or whatever it may be. But in general, if you want to know the best way to evangelize a person, asking the person questions is really the best way to start. Because if you don't know about the person's inclinations and their background, then you're kind of flying blind. You don't know what's going to be most effective for the person. So you say this gentleman has been baptized but has not received further sacraments. Do you know if he has displayed to this point any interest in religion? I think you said the Missionaries of Charity asked you to evangelize him. Has he displayed any interest in religion to them?
I think they have interaction with his mother because they actually live across the street from the convent, and so based on that relationship, I think the introduction was made. And so I had a brief conversation with him, but mm-hmm. the follow up is, you know, I kept thinking to myself, how am I going to do this? How do I follow up with this individual? Because based on those reasons I said so.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would do if I really didn't know much about him is I'd get together with him. Now it sounds like you've been introduced to him in a way, in a context where he knows religion is involved. And so that's good. Yeah. That means you don't have to bring up the topic. But you could say, hey, the nuns over in the convent thought it would be good if I got to know you and see if I could help you out. Why don't you tell me about yourself? You know, tell me about your life. Tell me about what you're interested in. Tell me about what you think about religion. Tell me about all that stuff. And that will generate lines of conversation that you can then develop with him, including the one about tell me what you think about religion. And you could say, you know, have you ever thought about going to church? I understand you haven't been confirmed yet or received communion yet. Wouldn't you like to do that to complete your faith, you know, to complete your initiation into the faith? And so I would just take a question asking approach and see what he says and keep asking questions, make invitations, including ones that don't have anything to do with religion, like, you know, go get a burger or go watch sports ball together or something, you know, find some common ground. So it seems like you're actually showing an interest in him, not just in him with respect to religion. Because if you communicate effectively to people that you really care about them as an individual, they're going to take what you have to say about religion and any other subject more seriously. So I would say I would ask him questions, including about religion, but not only about religion. And I would make invitations, including invitations, hey, you want to go to church together? I'd be happy to take you. Or, but also not only about religion, other things that you can do to get to know each other and have a little bonding.
Richard, thank you very much for that call and for that question. Jimmy, you used the phrase sports ball a couple times, and I wanted to tell you, a gentleman called yesterday and told us he doesn't play sports ball. So your phrase is being picked up out there.
Yeah. I don't play sports ball either.
No. Elias in Glendale, California, watching on YouTube. You are next, Elias. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, yes. This question is a bit personal, but there's been certain number combinations that I've been seeing more and more, sometimes repeatedly in the same day. They've been making me uneasy. And now the numbers that they've been are not the usual ones that everybody's afraid of. They're more personally related.
Okay.
And there's even been instances where there'll be numbers or even letters that form like a word. And this is like on license plates, you know, for example, and it feels like it's some kind of sign, but at the same time, the message that it seems to be conveying is a negative one where I need to look down on somebody that I know that I feel like I shouldn't look down on them or even on myself. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like one of those things where, you know, as us, when we're religious, we sometimes go, oh, look at that priest said this sermon and I heard this song. Oh, it kind of matches. And sometimes you have this feeling like something is giving you this, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily know 100%. It just feels like that. The thing is, with me, there's been this sort of almost like continuous, I guess you could call it a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's been
Elias,
affecting me. So that's basically the question. Like, how do we... Does our church say anything about not doing that?
Okay. The church doesn't have a document that says don't, you know, pay attention to number signs or things like that. It does say we shouldn't be superstitious. And so we then need to, you know, look further into this and say, is there a basis here for someone sending you a message, or is there no basis, in which case paying attention to the numbers would amount to kind of low-grade form of superstition. Are you comfortable telling me the numbers that or letters that you've been noticing lately?
On the air, no. Maybe on an email, personally. Okay. But...
okay. How many different numbers are there?
It's been actually increasing into different other combinations, but the main ones is two numbers that are right next to each other.
Okay. If there is a message being sent to you, now the first thing is when we're looking at, this is potentially a paranormal phenomenon, you know, something that goes beyond the normal, and that's what all paranormal means. And whenever we're considering something that might be paranormal, the first thing we need to look at are natural explanations. Are there natural explanations that could, you know, be responsible for you noticing these numbers? Well, the big one is humans are pattern matching monsters. I don't know about other species, but humans look for patterns. We identify patterns even in random data. For example, if you look at an old style TV screen, and you may be, Elias, you may be too young to remember these, but if you look at an old style TV screen, when there's no signal, you'll see this snowy static on it. Well, people would watch the snowy static and their subconscious would start putting together patterns. You know, I can remember watching a snowy TV screen when I was growing up, and I would see little spinning wheels in the pattern of static and things like that. Humans just look for patterns. We're programmed to, and we're biased in favor of finding a pattern even when there's no pattern there. And there's a very good reason for that, because, you know, our ancestors grew up out in the jungle, and you got all this motion of leaves and light and shadows around you. And sometimes you're going to see something that could just be random rustling of leaves, or it could be an indication there's a tiger that's about to leap out and eat you. And if you assume that there is a tiger and there's not, well, you're safe. But if you assume there's not a tiger and there is, you might get eaten. And so it's safer for us to assume that random stuff we see is actually a meaningful pattern. So we're biased in favor of seeing patterns, even when patterns aren't really there. So that's the first and big natural explanation that could be responsible for your experience. Having said that, it's not impossible that you could be sent a sign through numbers appearing. But we then need to ask another question, which is, who would be sending the sign? Well, some people might think it's the universe. The universe is sending me a sign. But the problem with that is that would be superstition, because the universe does not have a mind. The universe cannot send signals. So who could? Well, it could be God or one of God's agents, like an angel or a saint or something. Or it could be a demon. Okay, so those are possible sources, but it would need to be something like that, because no living human has the ability to send you a sign in this way. The universe does not have the ability to send you a sign in this way. If you're receiving a sign, it would have to come from someone like God or the devil or one of their agents. So how could we figure out if you're being given a sign? Well, there would be ways to test this, and an obvious way to test it would be to say, God, if you're sending me a sign, I need confirmation. I need to know that this is more than my human pattern matching going on here, that I'm just happening to notice these things, because that's a known phenomenon. It's sometimes called the 1111 phenomenon, where after people hear about the number 1111, they start noticing it everywhere. And so it's quite possible that some of these numbers got lodged in your subconscious. And now whenever you encounter them, your subconscious pops it up to your conscious awareness and says, hey, that's that number we've been looking for. Notice it's here. It's here right now. That could just be your subconscious doing it. So you could say, God, if this is you sending me a signal, I need you to show me that. And so please let me see that number right now and see if the number shows up. Well, it might show up randomly. It might show up just randomly. And so you wouldn't want to rest your decision based on just one test. You would want to do this repeatedly. I don't know, maybe 20 times. Say, God, please show me that sign right now, or please show me that number at 5 p.m. or something like that, and see if it happens. If the number does not regularly appear, then I would assume it's just pattern matching. It's just your subconscious noticed these numbers a while back and you've kind of got them stuck in there and there is no message. On the other hand, what if you see that it does? You try it 20 times and it appears 18 out of 20 times. Well, then that would be a stronger case that there is some kind of message going on here. And then we need to proceed to another question. Is the message consistent with God or with the devil? If the message is telling you to look down on someone, to judge them, or you look down and judge yourself, you know, just for no particular reason or whatever. Well, that's not the kind of message God would be sending you, because God is love. And so if the message is fundamentally negative, then even if there is a signal that's being sent to you, I would write it off and say it's not coming from God, so ignore it.
Elias, I'm going to, you know what, I was about to come back to you, but actually I'm going to leave it there and hope that that was helpful to you, because the music is about to play and we won't be able to have that back and forth because we got to go out to the break. But you're welcome to call back. Thank you very much for the call. Hey, all the lines are full right now. Maybe there'll be one line open during the break. You're welcome to give it a try. 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, a little bit of groovy music for you. It's a Thursday. Jimmy Akin's here. So nice to be back in the studio doing what I really love doing, and very grateful for you that I get to do it because you're here. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's open forum. Lines have been staying full, so back we go to the phones for Jimmy. Thomas is in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Thomas, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you for taking my call. So my question stems from a story I heard on Spirit Catholic Radio a couple weeks ago. I'm just going to dumb it down to the elements. A man, a priest, was talking about family members. There was a man who never believed in Christ and didn't have faith in his life. He lost consciousness due to a heart attack. And a woman was there and, I guess, performed what's called an emergency baptism on him. And the priest was talking about how he was confident that this man was in heaven or was saved in one sense. And then he went on to say with a disclaimer that because he never regained consciousness after he got baptized, he never committed any sins and therefore wouldn't have to go to purgatory. And I was just curious if this is consistent with Catholic teaching and where we might be seeing this coming from Scripture.
Okay, well, so we don't have anything in Scripture that directly addresses a situation like this, so I'm not going to be able to give you Bible verses, but we can reason about it based on theological principles that have roots in Scripture, you know, like baptism and you know, purgatory and so forth, as they that have been explored and developed by the church. So we can take church teaching and apply it to a situation like this. Now, one of the things that the church does not want to happen is for people to be baptized against their will. Baptism must be accepted voluntarily. And in a situation like this, I understand, you know, if you care about someone and they're in a coma and so forth, that you may want to just go ahead and baptize them. But unless they have shown some sign that they would want that, that they're open to being baptized, you're not supposed to do it. And so so we've kind of got a fork in a decision tree here. And the question to ask at the fork is, was the person fundamentally open to God or not? If the person was not fundamentally open to God, then even if you baptize him, it's not gonna have its effect. It's not gonna put sanctifying grace in his soul. And so he would not be saved if on whatever deep level down in his soul he was fundamentally closed to God. On the other hand, if he was deep down fundamentally open to God, even though he didn't ask to be baptized, then, and I'm assuming that for purposes of this discussion, even though he didn't ask to be baptized, if he was fundamentally open to God, then the baptism would have its effect. It would put sanctifying grace in his soul, and he would go to heaven. He would be saved. As far as the question of would he have to go to purgatory, well, the view that you articulated, this priest is saying that because he didn't commit any sins after his baptism since he was in a coma, that's not rejected by Catholic teaching. It is, in fact, an opinion that a lot of people have held. It has been thought historically, at least the common view has been that that what purgatory burns off or, you know, removes is the punishments of a temporal nature that are due to sins committed after baptism. And since this guy didn't commit any sins, then he wouldn't have anything to be removed by purgatory and he would go straight to heaven, assuming he was fundamentally open to God. However, in more recent times, the church has been articulating what purgatory does a little bit differently. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, or if you look in Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical Spes Salvi on Christian hope, it understands the so-called punishments of purgatory not as penalties that are inflicted from without because of specific actions people have done, but rather something that is more organic than that. And so in the Catechism, and this is also true in some of the audiences of John Paul II, it articulates the purpose of purgatory as freeing us from our disordered attachments, from the brokenness that we have that would lead us into sin. And so it's not so much like punishing a child, it's more like healing a broken arm, you know, and it's more organic. And on that understanding, it would not rule out someone needing to have some purification after their death, because we've all got brokenness, and that brokenness does not go away immediately upon getting baptized. So if this gentleman had disordered desires, you know, as part of his brokenness, which everybody does, you know, it under ordinary circumstances, at least all ordinary people do, if he had disordered desires that would continue to tempt him, if he had regained consciousness, then he would need to be purified of those disordered desires, because we're not going to be tempted in heaven. We won't have disordered desires in heaven. And so on that understanding, he very well could need to go through purgatory, not as a punishment, but as a healing measure.
Thomas, okay?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for the answer.
Thank you very much for the call and for the question. We got time to do another question before we have to go to the break. Let's go to Alex in Esmond, North Dakota, watching on Twitch. Alex, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, yeah. So I was looking at getting a job at a kind of local coffee bar. It's a chain company. And I went on their website to see if they supported any kind of charities and what they were. And I found that they supported just one. And it said something about, like, trying to get healthcare in, like, South American countries. And it was quite vague about, like, what exactly they meant by healthcare. And I couldn't find any more information. So my question is just, is it okay for me to go there and take this job, or do I need to look into it more?
Well, healthcare in South America is a good thing. Healthcare anywhere is a good thing. And in South America in particular, it's economically underdeveloped. There are some countries there that have really been ruined by their governments economically, and a lot of people don't have healthcare down there. So promoting healthcare is a good thing.
My question was more just if that might be something like abortion or something like that.
Well, even if it was, you know, it wouldn't be an automatic no for this job. What you have to look at is not do the people in the company do anything evil? Because if you can't take a job where people do anything evil, you're never going to have a job, because people in every company are sinners. They all do things that are evil, whether they talk about it in public or not. So as a result of that, Catholic moral theologians have developed what are called the principles for cooperation with evil, because we can't live in the world and not cooperate with people who are doing evil. So are you being asked to directly support abortion? Well, you have no indication of that. They haven't asked you to perform an abortion or, you know, pay for one or anything like that. At most, they may take some of their corporate earnings and devote that to a charity that maybe performs abortions with some of that money, but they're not even advertising that. So they're just saying we're promoting healthcare. That can mean giving people shots and helping babies get over illnesses and stuff. They're not even advertising abortion, and most companies these days are not shy about advertising it if that's what they're trying to do. So I would assume if they are having any involvement with abortion in these countries, it's going to be very minor. And if it's minor and you're not directly involved, then it's what is known as remote material cooperation. You're not formally cooperating because you don't approve of abortion. So the material the cooperation would be material rather than formal, which means you're not yourself sinning. And because they're just doing a tiny little bit of stuff, maybe that you're not involved in, that's clearly remote. And when your involvement with someone who's doing something evil is remote and material, it can be justified for a proportionate reason. Like, I need a job. And basically, no matter where you go, you're going to be cooperating with people who are in some way doing evil. So you're going to have remote material cooperation no matter where you go. Now, if this was the Abortions R Us coffee shop, where they were heavily involved in promoting abortion, and that was like their main corporate purpose, and they're just selling coffee to underwrite abortion advocacy or paying for abortions, well, I would say no, you wouldn't want to work there. But this sounds like remote material cooperation, and you're going to have that anywhere. And if you need a job, take what jobs are available.
You know, I'm going to leave it there because I got to take a quick break. We will take the break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
You know, we talk story with each of our very unique guests for the whole hour so that you can go deep with us as you yourself pursue your own story of heroic virtue and as you pursue intimacy with God.
The Bear Wozniak Adventure, Saturday night, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. This second hour is flying by for me. I don't know how it is for you, Jimmy, but I think I've enjoyed the questions this hour. It has scooted. So off we go back to the phones, try to get everybody who has called on with Jimmy before we have to go for the day. And Mary is in Massachusetts. Mary, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there. I'm going to be quick because I've got two children in the background. But my question is it okay to permanently substitute fasting from food with a different sort of fasting if you suffer from an eating disorder or if you are recovered from the eating disorder but want to avoid any sort of fasting in case it triggers something?
So this is, I assume we're talking about an eating disorder, something like anorexia nervosa, where you, where one is avoiding food in an unhealthy way, and you're concerned that if I fast, it could cause that condition to recur. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Is the eating condition medically diagnosed?
No.
Okay. Have you been put on a special eating plan by your physician?
No.
Okay. Well, I would say if it had been medically diagnosed, and especially if a physician had put you on a specific eating plan, then one would not be obliged to fast on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, which are the only 2 days that fasting is required. And it's a very mild fast. It's just you can have one full meal and two smaller meals, you know. So you even get to eat three times a day. It's not three full meals. Sometimes you'll hear people say the two smaller meals can't add up to a second meal, but that's nonsense. That is not in the law. That is a misinterpretation. You're allowed to have one full meal and two smaller meals. Now, if it's true that would put you at significant risk of reigniting this eating disorder and it causing significant harm to you, then you would be free from the obligation of fasting. However, I think it's important in cases like this to get a professional opinion or a second opinion on this kind of thing, either from a medical professional or from your spiritual director, if you have one, or your pastor, if you don't. You know, someone who knows you and knows the situation and can talk to you and say how much risk is really involved here. If the risk is significant, then absolutely, yes, you can do something else instead of fasting. You're not required to fast under those situations, and it's a good thing to voluntarily do something else. And so if there's significant risk, yes, this could be done. But given that you haven't been put on a special eating plan and given that this hasn't been medically diagnosed, I would say talk to a spiritual director or a pastor. One other thing to note is pastors have the ability to either dispense you from particular penitential practices or commute them to something else. So you could go to your pastor. This isn't any priest, but it is your pastor. And the same would be true of your bishop. But you can go to your pastor or your bishop and say, I have this eating disorder and I'm concerned that it will reignite if I start fasting on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. Can you commute this to something else? Can you let me pick some other penance? Or can you even dispense me from it? And they can do that.
Okay, Mary? Oh, did Mary, maybe, is that okay, Mary? Make sense?
Yes, I did not know about that last part, so that's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Wonderful.
No problem.
Wonderful. All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Toronto, Canada, where Lucy is waiting on the line. Lucy, thank you for your patience. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So I'm 14, and I'm an RCIA, and I actually called yesterday with a somewhat similar question, but I'm really struggling with kind of... Oh, I'm so sorry. So I'm 14, and I'm an RCIA,
right.
And I've been struggling with the fear of, like, the end times and the rapture in particular. Mm-hmm. I know, kind of heavy, but... it was kind of just, I've been kind of praying for like signs and for help. And, I was listening to an audiobook last night. I was going to bed and I woke up at around 3:30 in the morning and there was a podcast playing that I hadn't put on. And it was a podcast talking about how the rapture is real and, you know, how we should believe in it and how we should fear it. And so I was kind of freaked out and like, oh my gosh, is this a sign? Should I believe this? So I guess my question is, should I believe this as a sign from God?
Okay. So we had a caller earlier this hour who was also asking about signs. And one of the principles that I articulated to that gentleman was you want to look at the content of the proposed sign and say, is this consistent with what we know from God? And there are other things you can do in evaluating a sign. But if the message of the sign is not consistent with what we know from God, then you can just ignore it. It's either not a sign at all, or it's not a sign. It's a sign from someone other than God. So in this case, I don't think we need to do any testing because the idea of the rapture, as popularly understood, is not consistent with what we know from God. The idea of the rapture, as it's commonly understood, is that sometime a little more than 1,000 years before the end of the world, Jesus will return and snatch his church away and take it up to heaven with him for a period of a few years while all hell breaks loose on earth. And then Jesus will return and personally, physically reign on earth for 1,000 years before the actual end of the world. And that's a view that's known as pre-tribulational premillennialism. This view is actually only a couple hundred years old. It is not the historic Catholic view. It is not the historic Protestant view. It arose in a group called the Plymouth Brethren over in England in the 1820s, so just about 200 years ago. And it is not supported in the Bible. There is an event where Jesus returns and catches his church up to be with him in the clouds. But that's not over 1,000 years before the end of the world. That's at the end of the world. And this is, St. Paul discusses this in 1 Thessalonians 14. What he's referring to is a custom where if you had a visiting dignitary, like a general or a king or a governor is coming to visit you, the population would go out and meet him. And then they would escort him back to where they lived. And that's what's going on here. Jesus is going to return to earth, and so the church is going to go up to meet him and then accompany him back to earth, and he will then, it's going to be the end of the world, and we'll have the resurrection of the dead and the final judgment, and set up the new earth and the new heaven and reign. And this all happens right at the end of the world. It's not before that. And we have a lot more information about that, some of which I've written, at Catholic.com. So I would suggest, in addition to the answer I've just provided, go to Catholic.com and type in rapture, and you'll get a bunch of information about why this theory actually isn't supported in the Bible. If you carefully study what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, where he talks about this, and this is the only passage in the Bible that mentions this event, is in 1 Corinthians 4, but he's talking about the actual coming of Christ at the end of the world, not something over 1,000 years before that.
Okay, Lucy?
Yes, that makes very much sense. Thank you so much.
Oh,
no
thank
problem.
You. Thank you. And you're always welcome here. We'll look forward to talking with you again sometime. Let's see. We are off to Imperial Beach, California, just down the road from where we are. Timmy, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Go ahead, Timmy, with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
My question, I've got some buddies that I'm in a Bible study with who are Reformed, and it came up that basically the sacrifice of Christ on Calvary, that he loses his divinity, essentially, like when the Father's pouring out his wrath on the Son, and that it's only the man of Christ that dies, not like the divine aspect or the divine nature of Christ. And to me, that just sounded like kind of Nestorian. And then I looked it up on Legionnaire as well, and R.C. Sproul says kind of something similar. So I was just wondering how that squared with our view, and then how exactly Christ did, in fact, die on the cross, or God did.
So, Timmy, were these individuals Pentecostals or Charismatics or members of what's sometimes called the Word Faith movement?
No, it's like just San Diego Reformed Baptist Church, I believe.
Oh, really? Well, this is very surprising.
I can tell you exactly what that falls under.
Timmy, that's okay. Let me have a swing at the answer, because we're getting close to the end of the show, and I want to give you a good answer. It's very surprising that Reformed Baptists would say that. So Christ has his divine nature, his human nature is composed of a human spirit, a human soul, and a human body. Now, what happened when Christ died was his human body and his human spirit separated. And as James says in James chapter 2, the body without the spirit is dead. So when Christ died, his body and his human spirit separated. But that didn't cause any separation with his divine nature. His divine nature, you know, it remained united, like, to his human soul. There was no division there. If there had been, Christ would have split into two people. And as you mentioned, that's a heresy known as Nestorianism. So what happened on the cross was Christ's body, his human body, stopped functioning, and therefore it separated from his human soul, but his divinity did not split off. It was not removed. Nothing like that happened. Also, God wasn't literally pouring out his wrath on Jesus. That phrase is never used in the Bible. That's an artifact of theology in certain Protestant communions, but that is not the language of the Bible. That is not how the Bible describes what God did with Jesus. There's nothing about pouring out wrath on his son.
Timmy, that got to what you wanted to get to?
Yeah, no, thank you. That helps. I was just needed help.
Yeah.
Well, no problem.
Thank you very much. I wonder if we can get another one. Let's
try Ann on line three.
Ann, right here in San Diego, thank you for your call. You're going to have to be quick if you'd like an answer from Jimmy.
Okay, thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Sure, yeah.
Yes, real quick question.
Excellent. So really quick, thank you so much. I loved your...
you got to get a question. Ann, I need your question if you want an answer.
Okay, so the question is regarding the Son of Man and Daniel 7 and Jesus referring himself.
What's the question?
The question is, somewhere you had said he was referred to as part Yahweh, but
no.
Wouldn't, because Jesus is... Oh, okay. I thought you had said that, partly Yahweh.
Mm-mm. Nope.
Okay.
No, Jesus, and who is the Son of Man, is Yahweh. He is not partly Yahweh. He has, in addition to his divine nature as Yahweh, he also has a human nature. But if you say he's partly Yahweh, it would be theologically misleading, so I would not say that.
And we kind of addressed you there a little bit. If you'd like a copy of Jimmy Akin's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, I'd love to send it to you.
Yeah.
Because we had to scooch you off kind of quick. But thanks to everybody who called. We will be here tomorrow if we didn't get to you, but only just one call we didn't get to. Jimmy, thank you. That was yeoman's work today, getting through all those calls.
My pleasure.
Don't forget, tomorrow, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops. This one, are aliens demons? Are they all demons? Jimmy looks at the evidence, as always, from the perspective of reason and faith, and comes to some conclusions. So check it out. Mysterious.fm is the place to go. Rose Sweet will be here tomorrow. And I think we're going to talk with Matthew Bunsen, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, about the church in the news. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.